soccer, nonsense, and everything in between. Some Canadian guys talking about soccer.
All right, hello everyone, and thanks for listening to the Some Canadian Guys Talking About Soccer podcast, available on sportsnet.ca and on iTunes. So head over and subscribe, why don't you? This is Daniel Squizzato, a.k.a. Squiz, and I'm joined by my two fellow writers, fellow podcasters, and fellow Canadian guys. First, the mad scientist of this show. He also writes at CanadianSoccerNews.com, Grant Surridge. Grant, how's it going?
Good. The nuclear bomb is well on its way to completion.
That doesn't work so well if you're overt about it. You should pretend that you're launching a weather satellite or something like that.
Okay. The weather satellite is well on its way to completion.
You're not supposed to rub your hands together maniacally when you're talking about your weather satellite.
You're a mad scientist.
If you had a mustache, you'd probably be twirling it nefariously at this point as well. That other voice you hear is the third member of our troop, the ethically conflicted but ultimately complicit scientist. He's also a soccer writer for Sportsnet.ca and senior editor at Sportsnet magazine, Jamie Doyle. Jamie, how are you?
I'm not here for the evil. I'm here for the science.
Come for the science. Stay for the evil.
And Grant has also said that, well, he's kind of let the cat out of the bag that he is working on some kind of a nuclear weapon. But you said earlier that when I claimed that you spent the night after Chelsea won their Champions League semifinal, that you didn't have exposure to radiation because I claimed that you'd probably just spent the night emitting a low buzz and glowing eerily. That we now know that that's actually not true.
I was just trying to throw you off the case.
Right. I lost track of what you meant about halfway through that sentence, so I'm going to move on from the talks of nukes into what we're going to be talking about relating to soccer on this show. We're going to be speaking to player-turned-broadcaster Carl Lang, who's going to talk about the Olympic draw that the Canadian women's national team has received and what their chances look like at the upcoming London Games. We will also be speaking to Toronto Star columnist Cathal Kelly. He's never been afraid to express his opinions about Toronto FC. He had some strong ones in the aftermath of this past weekend. We're going to ask him a little bit about those and what he thinks about the Reds going forward. Later on in promotion relegation, we will hit on such topics as tough calls for silence, and horrible, horrible crimes. And stay tuned as we resume regularly scheduled programming in Taste the Trivia. But before any of that, gentlemen, before we get into the interviews, a couple of other issues on the domestic scene I thought we should just get into, if we could. If everyone can put their bombs and missiles aside for a couple of minutes. A name that will ring familiar to some longtime followers of the Canadian men's national team is Jacob Lenski. And the news came out late last week that he is, or at least was, on trial with the Vancouver Whitecaps. Now, Lenski's story in a nutshell, born in Canada, came up through the Canadian system, was given a call-up to the men's national team, but turned it down in order to go play for the under-21 setup in the Czech Republic. He has been on trial in North America in the past few years. He also played in Europe for a number of years, but he's also retired from the game twice at the age of 23. And as we're learning, as has been confirmed from his last club, FC Utrecht, he has some substance abuse and mental health issues, to put it mildly. So when it comes to the Whitecaps giving 23-year-old Jacob Lenski a shot, Grant, you can take whatever facet of this you want. When you hear this news, when you hear about this, how do you react?
I'm going to maintain my stance, the stance I had with Teal Bunbury. My outrage in these situations is always in proportion to how good the player is when it comes to sort of abandoning Canada. So I'm not too wound up by the fact he's playing or has a trial with Vancouver. It doesn't really even register in my thought process. Good for him.
Okay. I think he's a better player than you're giving him credit for.
Okay.
I don't know. Right. Did you just get a little bit angrier there?
Grant,
a little bit.
Grant, he's really a terrific player.
I'm really getting mad.
He could tear up the Czech fifth division if given the chance. Wait, that's not him. But, you know, it's not necessarily just that he had a chance to play for the men's national team and turned it down, because there's a lot of, as I said, personal issues involved with him there. But there's also the fact that MLS, the Canadian MLS teams have this Canadian player quota of 3. And theoretically, if Lenski were to catch on with the club and make the senior team, he could be taking up one of those spots that theoretically could be filled by younger up-and-coming Canadian. Jamie, is that something that worries you at all or even matters?
It could even be taken up by Alain Rochette. Oh, wait a minute.
Yeah, another Canadian-born player who decided to represent another country internationally.
Yeah, I mean, Vancouver doesn't necessarily have a great record with this kind of thing, but you can argue that they're just them being a better team is it will do more for Canadian soccer than them plugging in some Canadian who doesn't really deserve to be there. So, there's an argument to be made both ways. Now, whether Jacob Lenski is good enough, it remains to be seen. Whether or not he's good enough and he's stable enough and he's in the kind of place that he can be to actually play professional, if he wants to play professional soccer. I mean, these things are all really up in the air. But at the end of the day, it's a professional team, and if you're good enough, you're good enough.
So he could theoretically...
Yes, he could.
...play for Canada now if he decides that he wanted to.
I don't know. There seems to be some kind of confusion over that. I don't think he can because he switched nationalities once, and he played a game for the Czech
setup. When I say yes, I mean I don't know.
No, I thought he only played for the...
He played for the under-21s, yeah. But he'd played in the Canadian youth setup?
Yes.
So he'd switched nationalities once officially, and you can't switch again, my understanding.
All right. Well,
but these things seem pretty...
Kind of like the situation with a guy you mentioned earlier, Teal Bunbury.
Yeah.
And, you know, you bring up his name, and that's a member of this list of players that have at one time given the impression they'd play for Canada on the highest stage and then gone somewhere else. You know, Owen Hargreaves and that Bosnian goalie that plays for Stoke City. And names like this really dredge up a lot of angry emotions among Canadian supporters, but I'm getting the sense from you guys that when it comes to Lenski, it's just like, eh. It doesn't, you know, he doesn't stir up that same outrage as in the case of other players.
Not really for me, no.
There was anger at the time. There was definitely, like, people were really frustrated at the time because it wasn't just that he got a call and turned it down. Like, he said he was going to accept the call, and then when it came, he turned it down. So he made the call himself, and then... Now,
there was that rumor he also informed Stephen Hart by email, which I'll irresponsibly spread here.
Okay.
That's terrific. You're really, really bolstering our professionalism here, Grant, by spreading things with no corroboration.
Mongering he is.
So suffice to say, it kind of seems that not even not outrage, but Jamie, you said before we started recording there's even a bit of sympathy there for him, just as an individual, as a person?
He's become kind of a sympathetic character. If he's actually... just a messed up kid who doesn't know what he wants. Maybe it's even up in the air whether or not he actually wants to be a professional soccer player, whether he was pushed into it by his parents. And if he's got this whole basket of substance abuse and probably mental health issues on the side, then it's hard to get angry at a person like this.
So then Lenski notwithstanding, let's, you know, perhaps find another reason for people to get angry. Not just us, but also people in Vancouver and elsewhere. Grant, you wanted to bring up this topic and we alluded to it a bit earlier. It was crystallized in a post on CSN last week by Dwayne Rollins, which is called The 0% Shame. And this was the number referred to the percentage of playing time given by the Vancouver Whitecaps so far this year in the MLS season to players that are eligible to play for Canada internationally. And that number came from tabulations done by Jono over at Out of Touch. Join his Voyageurs Cup pool. Which I think also said that Montreal currently sits at 4% for the season. So, you know, you wanted us to talk about this, and you think this is something worth discussing. And this is something that Whitecaps fans addressed last year as well. They wanted to get Philippe Davies some time on the field, never saw a minute in MLS. So what do you think? Does this matter in the short term whether or not the Whitecaps and the Impact and Toronto FC are playing Canadian players now, or is it more of a long-term approach when it comes to the academy?
I mean, I don't think it matters so much in the short term. I mean, I think it's important. I mean, you're seeing what's happening here with TFC when the team starts 0-6. I mean, I think there's a real danger that it just kind of turns people off soccer, MLS soccer.
Okay, but
altogether.
Wait a minute. Are you saying Toronto started 0-6 because they're playing too many Canadians?
I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying...
Okay, but then what's the connection between the two?
The connection is that they shouldn't try to jam players into their first team who they don't think are good enough just because they're eligible to play for the Canadian national team.
Well, I don't think Toronto has done that.
No, but I think...
Toronto as the case of a team doing really crappily.
Yeah. That would be the foremost case of a team doing crappily in MLS right now.
And I think their main concern should just be doing well with the players that they have available to them, regardless of where they're from. I mean, the rule's there. They have to have these players on, so these players are going to develop whether they see a lot of the pitch or not.
Is that true, though? I mean, we complain about...
Yeah, but where else are these players going to go?
Well, I'm saying, you know, we look at Canadian players, a guy like Simeon Jackson, for instance, at Norwich, or David Edgar for a number of years, playing, playing at a high level, or sorry, being part of a team that's at a high level in England. But if they're sitting on the bench, you know, people have said, well, maybe that rather than sitting on the bench at a higher level, they should be getting more regular playing time at a different level. So when it comes to these kids like Russell Tybert and Bryce Alderson and an academy kid the Whitecaps signed this week, Caleb Clark, is it better for them to be sitting on the bench for the Whitecaps' first team and maybe playing reserve games every now and again, or would it benefit them more to stay at the academy or to be loaned out to a different team to get more regular playing time?
I think if you're sitting on the bench for years and years, that obviously has a negative effect. But these guys are all competitors. They don't want to go play in a crappier league just because they'll get a lot of time. They want to compete for a spot in a better league. I think it's a weirdly Canadian kind of thing to say, like, well, he might not be good enough for this league, so let's let him play at a lower league where he'll get on the field more, and maybe it's just supporters we want to see these guys play more.
I would have to assume it would be within the Whitecaps' long-term business plan to have players in their first team who are from Vancouver and came through their academy.
Yeah, and and this is something Bob Leonarduzzi, team president, was on the soccer show a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about this. And obviously the academy, bringing up players through your academy has not just that public relations benefit to it, especially for Canadian teams, but it has a financial benefit to it because those homegrown players don't count against your salary cap. Now, their salaries would probably be minimal anyway, but when you're dealing with a league where the salary cap is less than $3 million, every little bit of money you can save is advantageous. And so, you know, if filling out the Canadian quota for now on MLS teams means having guys like Alain Rochat and, you know, Eddie Sabrango, bless his heart, on the rosters of these teams, if that is the temporary holdover until the point where these academies start turning out players that are going to make these first teams. And, you know, I mentioned the kids in Vancouver. There's kids coming up in the Montreal Academy whose names are going to be familiar, who've represented Canada. There's, of course, Evan James, who, turned some heads at the Olympic tournament. Carl Hayworth was on the team as well. Maxime Crepeau, a goalkeeper who was with the U-17s of the World Cup. So, I mean, there are kids coming up through the system,
is there necessarily a way back? Like, the way I understand, the CSA has sort of sanctioned these teams to compete in MLS with the understanding they will help develop players for the national team. But is the CSA really at any point going to take that away from them? And as they know, you can't play in MLS?
Well, I mean, ultimately, they do need...
I guess theoretically they could.
I mean, they need sanctioning from the CSA. Actually, you know what? That's a good question. The sanctioning would come from the CSA.
Yeah, I mean, this is the whole issue, right?
Well, do you think, for instance, one of the teams suddenly said, you know what? We don't really care about putting any Canadian players on the team. We're just going to field who we think is going to be best.
I don't know they'd even necessarily do that, but like you said, kind of just not... I mean, the way I understand it is there's supposed to be this agreement. I have no idea what this agreement is, that the MLS clubs will help develop players for the national team. And if in like 5 to 10 years they've obviously not done that, I don't really know what the CSA is going to do about it.
Jamie, will they do anything?
Well, no, and I don't see how that there even needs to be an agreement. I mean, it's obviously in these teams' best interest to recruit from this huge pool of unrecruited players in their respective regions, and that will just naturally lead to better things for the Canadian national team.
Yeah, but that's a byproduct of it. Like
agreement just seems to be we'll talk about this byproduct that's going to happen anyways, and then away we go.
Yeah, and
these guys are obviously going to play the players that come up through their team that are good enough to play. And it seems like the three Canadian players rule is more or less they'll pay lip service to it, but then they're going to do what any professional team does anywhere and just play the best players they have.
So at this point, it's just kind of hoping that the players that come through these academies do fulfill that role and do, you know, are providing the best option for the first teams then of their respective clubs.
I guess you would hope so, and it makes sense to just assume that's a viable endpoint for all this, because there's all these players around Toronto who aren't getting anywhere.
Well, I certainly hope so, because there doesn't seem to be another plan.
Well, no, but this seems reasonable. And the other thing is, It just seems the argument that like these teams are failing Canadian soccer, like the Vancouver is not doing its job, is just seems to rest pretty heavily on the idea that when Vancouver made it into MLS, there's just this this collection of MLS worthy players just wandering around Vancouver waiting to be scooped up by the team. I mean, it takes a while to develop these guys. It's ridiculous almost to think that they should just come in and have like this very Canadian roster that apparently what no one had noticed before.
Right, that's the thing, and that's one of the points that Leonard Doozy was making a couple of weeks ago. I mean, you know, the Vancouver Academy has turned out players that have had success internationally. You know, Randy Edwini Bonsu, Marcus Haber. Well, Ethan Gage was highly touted, doesn't really play at Reading, but he's over there anyway. You know, there are players that have come through their academy that obviously had a large amount of talent, but like you say, Jamie, we all remember what Toronto FC looked like in season one, where they were told you need to have a whole bunch of Canadians, and they just kind of desperately grabbed at whoever was sitting around. Once that, well, no, Chris Pozniak was pretty good, but anyway, you look now, they're in their sixth season, and they realistically have one player that has become a first team regular as a result of their academy, and that's Ashton Morgan. And I would say that he's there largely on merit, but I would say that considering how up against the cap the team is with three designated players and a lot of money tied up with other players, you can't discount the possibility that Ashton Morgan's place in the first team has something to do with the fact that his salary, whatever he's making, doesn't count against the cap. That's not to take anything away from his talent or what he's been able to achieve, but people say, yo, Toronto's graduated, whatever it is, seven kids from the academy, but Nick Lindsay's career, unfortunately, might already be done with his injuries. Quillen Roberts was an emergency call-up because Stephen Fry got hurt, and a couple of other guys, Oscar Cordone had a lot of potential spoken of last year, but he hasn't cracked the first team. Keith Makabuya is a reserve for the most part. And so it's not as though...
I think it takes a while for the academy to get kind of up and kicking, though, right?
Exactly.
Up and kicking.
So the 0% shame is maybe not a shame, but Jamie, you spoke earlier about the fact that clubs are ultimately going to do what's in their best interest, what's in their financial self-interest. I ranted about this last week, so let's just quickly make some predictions here about the now-confirmed friendly between Toronto FC and Liverpool at the Rogers Centre this summer. I'd like you guys to make a prediction as to what the attendance would be, and I would like you to make a prediction as to what percentage of that attendance will actually be there to support Toronto. Grant, why don't you go first?
Well, I did some looking at some numbers. So apparently,
you just scribbled those down.
I just scribbled them down.
But then he looked at them.
Now I'm looking at them. In Toronto, in the GTA, you've got 125,000 people who were born in the UK.
That's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people. Mm. So, and I mean, obviously, only a fraction of those are going to be Liverpool fans. Then you've actually got another 185,000 who have at least one parent from the UK.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Again, a small fraction of those are going to be Liverpool fans, but it kind of leads me to believe that, you know, we're going to get a fairly decent crowd for this game. With most of the people supporting Liverpool, because given everything I've read...
Numbers.
I don't know, 30,000? 35,000?
What percentage
is supporting Liverpool and what percentage is supporting TFC?
Yeah.
I'm going to say maybe 5% supporting TFC.
All right. Jamie?
That seems really small. I mean, there's a lot of angry TFC fans, but there's a lot of other people who are just like, ooh, a game. Ooh, TFC.
Yeah, I mean, it is hard to say because often
these days, is anybody saying, ooh, TFC, I want to go.
Liverpool is playing TFC, and I don't care about Liverpool, but I've heard that they're big and all.
The problem with angry TFC fans is that they're very disproportionately noisy. So it's kind of like I'm reading all the stuff that everyone's furious about it, but who knows? There might be a lot of casual fans who just kind of go... That's true. Their TFC shirt and are happy to do it.
I like Grant's first number of 30,000, and I'll go 80-20 on the percentage. Pro Liverpool.
All right. Now, I'm going to read from an article.
But I'll also say that there will be 0% of me going and 100% chance of me just kind of being bitter about the whole thing.
Yeah, I think there's a 0% chance of any of us being there. And
Squiz might chop off his hand and send that in the mail. But
what's that going to do? Why would I do that?
Yeah. Well, it'll do one thing. It'll make it hard to mail the hand.
Yeah. What?
One-handed
You ever tried commandeering an envelope with one hand? It's difficult.
No, I haven't.
I'm going to read from this article I sent you guys. Oh, I printed it out. I thought you guys would have had it, too. This is just some PR nonsense on Liverpool's website talking to... Jamie, here you go.
I'll take one of these printouts.
Yeah. Well, it's very long.
No, I know. I read it.
And talking to some like Liverpool fan in Toronto who we've probably seen, you know, I don't know who the guy is, I don't remember the name, but he's probably someone we've seen drunk at Scallywags at 9 a.m. Mm. And one of the questions he's asked is, what about Toronto? Will they provide a stern test? The answer from this fellow is, well, they've lost their first six games of the season and haven't won anything since 1967. I don't know what the hell that's even supposed to mean. I mean, it's a dig at the Maple Leafs, but apparently this guy has never heard of Major League Baseball or, you know, the Canadian Football League. But
he's too
anyway.
Busy watching Liverpool.
Actually, yeah, he's probably never heard of any domestic sport. He's too busy pretending he lives overseas. But this will be a big game for them, I'll bet. The players will be playing against their heroes, so it won't be easy. Yes. I think that Torsten Frings probably regards Andy Carroll as a hero. He's going to look across the pitch and say, my goodness, where am I? Yeah. Can I really be here? You know, Luis Suarez also just a role model for...
That's assuming those guys are actually on the pitch.
Actually, yeah. Who am I kidding? Torsten Frings from whatever hotel he's watching the game on TV from, and Andy Carroll, you know, wherever he is in England. You guys can make some libelous suggestions there.
Scunthorpe.
Yes, so all those guys I mentioned earlier, Oscar Cordon, Matt Stinson, Ashton Morgan,
there you go.
Keith Macabuya, Quillen Roberts, they're all going to be staring across the pitch at their idols.
There'll be no 0% shame going on in this game.
No, the 0% shame.
100% pride.
Yeah. Jamie, you find anything, any other screamers in there? Or howlers or whatever you'd call them?
Well, see, the one thing I think there might be... I don't know why I'm trying to defend this guy, but I think that the Liverpool people have probably edited this guy's quote, and that's where they came up with the 1967
thing. Directly from the Liverpool FC website, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So they probably edited his answers, and that's where this 1967 thing.
How much are tickets to this game? Have they announced that yet?
I don't think they've been officially announced, but expensive. And you know what ticket you can get much cheaper, and this is something you'll be able to read about at CSN today, I imagine. If you are someone in the Toronto area who is disappointed about this friendly taking place, a Toronto FC fan or anybody, or if you are a fan of Canadian soccer or children and you live anywhere in the country, anywhere in the world and you're hearing this, if you want to show your displeasure and you want to go to a game this summer, a big game featuring a team in red in Toronto, or at least be a part of it, rather than buying a ticket to that game, head over to the Voyageurs website and purchase a charity ticket to send a kid, an underprivileged kid from Toronto Community Housing, to the Canada v. Honduras World Cup qualifier. If you're in the GTA and you can make it yourself, you can get tickets for $20-25, perfectly reasonable. Those are the cheapest prices. Come on down and see it live. If you can't, you live anywhere, head over to cansoc.org. There's a link there. You can buy tickets to send a kid to the stadium. And we may not be able to do anything about the number of Liverpool fans that are going to show up at the Rogers Centre, but no matter where you are, you can do your part to minimize the number of Hondurans that are there for World Cup qualifying. Put a Canadian kid in the seat. It's very easy. That's all I got. Anything else, gentlemen, before we move on?
No, I was reading more of
that. Desperately looking for quotes from Mr. Liverpool.
Yeah, and it's the best thing in the world, he says. And
I think
what you just said, the idea of buying a ticket for an underprivileged person, a Canadian, that's a much better thing in the world.
Well, it also kind of bothers me, too, when I think...
Now going to undermine underprivileged children.
No, I'm not going to undermine any children, least of all underprivileged ones. All I'm saying is, this guy, Mr. Liverpool, is taking his kid to this match. I have no idea if he's going to go see Canada play or not, or if he ever goes to see TFC play. But if he doesn't, my question would be, why not?
Well, that's another issue for another day, Grant.
I know.
Because Kenny Dalglish is nowhere to be found.
That's it. If Stephen Hart doesn't work out, King Kenny for Canada. We are going to move on to the first of our two interviews on this show. First up, we are going to be speaking to player turned broadcaster who's going to be telling us about the women's national team at the upcoming Olympic Games, Cara Lang, after this. Joining us now on the line, player turned broadcaster, Cara Lang. Cara, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure.
Now, Canada has drawn a tough group for the upcoming Olympic Games: Japan, Sweden, and South Africa. Some fans have gone to the extent of calling it the group of death, but you've written that you don't necessarily agree. You believe that one of the other groups is actually the more foreboding one. But in any event, how do you feel about the draw that Canada's gotten?
Well, you know, I think that in this tournament, it was going to be tough no matter what. Even group the Brazil, Great Britain group, you know, that would have been tough as well. Brazil's a good team. Great Britain's going to have all of London behind them. And, you know, I think that there really was no way that it was going to be an easy go for Canada in this tournament. It's a very high-level tournament. I think maybe as far as women's international tournaments go, it will be one of the most competitive. I think the World Cup last summer was the highest level of soccer we've seen yet, and I think that this is even going to be a step above that. And, you know, in terms of tough groups, I think the group with France and the U.S. is certainly the toughest one, just because, in my opinion, the USA and France are the best teams in the world right now. I think to get the games against Japan and Sweden over with early on are actually beneficial to Canada. I think, you know, where it might be tough for them is having to play Canada or France in the crossover. Not to look too far ahead, because they'll certainly have to put the work in group play, but there's also the fact that, you know, the two top place third teams go through. So for Canada not to make it out of their group in this situation, I think would be extremely disappointing and in my opinion, unlikely.
So it seems like one of the big things that Canada has to do to get out of their group is maybe, if you discount the idea of beating Japan, who are the reigning World Cup champions, is getting past Sweden. And Canada's record against Sweden recently is kind of split. What do you think Canada has to focus on to make sure that they play a winning game against Sweden?
Well, I think, you know, they match up against Sweden very well. I think on a good day, Canada should beat Sweden. I wasn't overly impressed with them in the World Cup. Their captain and center midfielder, Caroline Sager, she didn't perform up to her potential last summer. So, you know, if she's playing well, I think that they're going to have to watch out for her. You know, she really orchestrates their entire offense, and she's also a dangerous threat on offense as well. But I think Canada, that the last time that they played Sweden, they were working out a lot of kinks. They've still got quite a while to prepare for the tournament. And I think, you know, even though they did well in qualifying, and a lot of people were very impressed with the new Canadian team and their look, and, you know, under John Herdman, he is still a new coach. And so they've still got some things to iron out. And from what I've heard, they're doing that, and they're all getting more and more comfortable with the new formation every day. So, you know, I think that they'll certainly be ready for Sweden by the time they have to play them.
Now, there's going to be a little bit more adjustment needed as well, because there are a couple of important players that have been brought back into Canadian camp and hopefully will be ready to go in time for the Olympic Games. One of those players is an old teammate and friend of yours, Diana Matheson,
mm-hmm.
who's been out of the team for about 6 months with knee surgery. Having played with her and knowing what you know about her, what impact could she have on this team when she comes back?
It'll be huge. You know, you may not have been able to tell because, like I said, they played well in qualifying, but they missed Diana Matheson out there for sure. She's just a calming presence, and she's a leader, and she's a workhorse. You know, especially in games like we saw against the U.S. where maybe athletically Canada didn't quite match up, and their fitness, I expect, will be better by the time they get to London. But all the same, having Diana Matheson out there, who literally can run for days, is always going to be beneficial for Canada. And she's just, you know, she will really center that midfield. Of course, Desiree Scott has kind of cemented her spot there as the holding midfielder. But wherever Herdman decides to put Diana Matheson, she's going to have an enormous impact. And then also Janelle Foligno, she's been brought back into camp. She wasn't there for qualifying. And, you know, other than Christine Sinclair, she's probably the biggest threat on offense for Canada. And really, I think that sort of missing piece to the puzzle that Canada needs, so that they're not just relying on Christine to score goals. So it'll be interesting to see the difference with both Diana Matheson and Janelle Foligno in the lineup.
Yeah, head coach John Herdman said earlier this week that Janelle being back with the team is obviously good news, but she still is fighting to recover from the injury she had and the surgery she had on her ankle. So, I mean, we'll have to wait and see if she can get back to 100% in time for the tournament. But the team is, of course, in camp right now over in Vancouver as part of their pre-Olympic preparations. What does it mean to the team, or what positive benefit could it have to be doing their training and their preparations on home soil?
You know, I think that after their training camp, their residency camp pre-World Cup last year in Rome, I think that they're extremely grateful to be able to be in Canada, just a much more comfortable environment. The resources, I think, are actually a lot better. You know, maybe they might not have the same opportunities to play friendlies against other countries, but I think overall the training environment is very high level. And, you know, John Herdman runs a very tight ship, so you know, they're more comfortable, but they're also working extremely hard. I was there last week, actually, or this past weekend, and got to see a little bit of their training and just the stuff that they're doing and talking to their girls. You know, we laughed a little bit. I was like, things have changed, huh, ladies? Just especially not even just compared to a year ago, but just in the previous Olympic preparations. You know, it's just there's not really a single stone unturned at this point, and I think it bodes well for Canada's chances.
Now, this is going to be the Olympics, that is, the biggest tournament that this team has taken part in since last year's Olympic Games, or last year's World Cup, I should say. Obviously, very high hopes going into that tournament and a lot of disappointment coming out of it. Herdman has spoken about the need to help the team psychologically recover from that result. He's brought in a sports psychologist to help in that regard. So having seen the team and been with the team over the weekend, what sense do you get of their mood as the Olympic Games are coming closer and closer?
You know, I think that they're in probably just the best mind state that they could be in. They're certainly not overconfident. And, you know, I think after going through what they did in Germany last summer, you can't help but learn from something like that. I think John Herdman is really giving them the tools that they need to deal with that kind of pressure and the confidence that they need. You know, you can just tell everybody's a lot happier. Everybody is just a lot more relaxed in some ways, but then in other ways, in talking to the players, they've never been in a more competitive environment. So, you know, I think he finds that balance where he allows the players to be themselves and he gives them the freedom to play, but at the same time, nobody's complacent. Nobody is a shoe-in for any position on the field necessarily. I mean, I did say Desiree Scott has kind of got that position cemented, which, you know, I fully believe that, but it's only because the team completely respects her and just trusts her in that role. But in terms of competition for positions, everybody else is fighting day in and day out for their spot. And I think that that's kind of going to build that mental strength that they need to deal with the adversity that they're going to see in London.
Now, I mentioned, of course, the hype that the team had behind it going into last year's World Cup, and we all unfortunately remember how that turned out. So it might be a bit dangerous to ask for prognostications about the Olympics, but, you know, what's life without a little bit of danger? So I'm going to ask, from your perspective, looking at where the team is now and looking at the way their group is turning out and what their path will be, in your opinion, you know, if things fall into place, as you say, if the team plays the way that they're capable of playing, can Canada seriously challenge for a medal in London?
You know, I can't say that I'm comfortable making a prediction that far.
Oh, live on the dangerous side a bit, Cara. Come on.
I will say I predict that they certainly make it out of their group, and I think that they're going to win the quarterfinal matchup, whoever they face. You know, I can't see them going home in the quarterfinals like we did in 2008 in Beijing. You know, after that, though, it's really tough to say. Like I said, France is just such a good team, and the U.S. is just so good. And I think that Brazil, with the group that they're in, you know, not to say that it's going to be an easy road for them, but I think that we can definitely count on them being in the knockout round. And so, you know, when you look at those teams, and then, of course, not to mention Japan, reigning world champion, it's a little foreboding. But I think that, you know, it's not something That's impossible. Absolutely not. I think that there's a chance that they can be on the podium for sure. I think, you know, watching the Champions League and this past week, I think we can all agree that really in soccer, anything's possible. And, you know, I think that this team with the mentality that they've got and the mental toughness that I expect to see from them, which would be, you know, something new, I think that they certainly have the potential to be on the podium.
So you're saying the gold medal is a lock? Yeah.
Pragmatic optimism. I like it. That has been Kara Lang. Kara, thanks for taking the time once again to talk to us.
Thank you.
Joining us on the line now is Toronto Star columnist Cathal Kelly. Cathal, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, guys.
You've been writing about Toronto FC for several years now, and you've never shied away from expressing your opinion. And so I'm going to read the lead from your column that you wrote after the most recent loss for the team. It was characteristically unambiguous. Quote, "Let's be honest with each other. The Toronto FC season is done." And yet, Aaron Vinter said this week that he believes the team will still make the playoffs, but I'm guessing that that doesn't change your view at all?
No. I mean, if we historically go back to teams that have started this bad, they don't make the playoffs. I mean, I can think of Kansas City starting last year on an absolute, I couldn't quote it, but an absolute horrible run, and then pulling it together. But if something was slightly different there, of course, they didn't play many of, I think about their first dozen games, they had to play away because mm-hmm. they were still building their stadium. So I don't think those are analogous situations. You know, Aaron Vinter, what else is he going to say at this point? I have a lot of sympathy for the guy, but I don't think at this point, given the way they've played, given what the record is, and given where you think they have to be to make a playoff spot around mid-40s in points, I really don't think it's possible anymore. And considering I think they're probably going to lose another one this weekend in Utah.
So, Cathal, you talked a little bit in your column about Vinter sort of losing the dressing room. Do you think that is what is actually happening?
I think he may have. Well, I mean, given the quote, I don't want to read people's minds here, but given the way guys have reacted, given things I've heard, and given the fact that he seems to be saying things, I used an example of Torsten Frings and about the fact that late in the game he pushed himself up into the center forward position, which seemed to muddle everything. I mean, the whole organization, what little there was of it, fell apart at that point. And I thought they'd been doing really well until that point. I think until about 60 minutes when they brought in De Guzman and took off Dunfield, I thought that had been their most effective offensive game, league game, yet this year. Reggie Lamb was just in acres of space down the right side, and that was working again and again. But then everything went sideways. I went to Vinter, and I asked him, was that Frings' idea that he push himself up? And he said, no, that was my idea. And then I went to Frings, and I said, was that your idea that you push yourself up? And he said, yeah, it was my decision. So when you've got the captain of the team, the most experienced player, the player that other players are looking to, when that guy has sort of gone off the reservation, so to speak, and decided he's going to start doing the things he thinks are right for the team, I think you've lost something of your command of the room.
It seems then that there's a big problem of Vinter and his system against the players, and they're not really coming together. Is Vinter then being too kind of rigidly dogmatic with his system and not facing the realities of the guys he actually has on the field?
Well, I think, you know, you see him, you want a coach that, I think we'd all agree, you want a coach that has a concept, that he has a concept, he goes in whatever sport you're talking about, that he has a tactic, he has a philosophy, he's able to articulate that philosophy to the guys on the team, and then they go out and they enact that philosophy. And this, he clearly has a philosophy, it's just not working. And so he's not able to make those adjustments. I mean, the thing I banged on about this season is that they have no defensive pressure in midfield. They don't really have a midfield at all. They really have a forward line and a back line. And so teams, we saw it again and again in that game in Chicago, are in complete, there's a chasm of space in the middle where a team can just cut you apart with through balls and then run onto them. He doesn't seem to be able to instruct his players, and maybe this is, as he suggested after the last game, this is a problem of quality in the squad. But quality in the squad is really down to him. He was the guy that was meant to assemble this team. So whatever failures there are on that part have to rest on his shoulders. So I'm not sure at this point what he can do. I'm very curious to see how he approaches this game on the weekend.
Now, Vinter has said over the past couple of weeks that the team has fallen victim to a bit of bad luck. And, I mean, we've seen that in the course of the game. The chances they've created have either hit posts, been remarkably saved, gone just wide. And so his argument has been the team is creating chances. If they weren't creating chances at all, we might be talking about a different situation. But now sitting 0-6, the rumbles are coming up a bit about the fact that his job may be at stake here. You've got people saying it's 0-6, you need to throw the baby, the bathwater, the entire room out. Others saying, look, he said he had a 3-year plan. You can see little bits and pieces of it coming together here and there. Even if the results aren't there yet, you kind of have to give him a chance to just play it out at this point, and the team can't have the upheaval that would come with another coaching change. What side of that do you fall on? Is this a situation where Aaron Vinter is a few weeks away from being out of Toronto, or is he going to be given the chance to enact his vision as he has suggested he will?
Well, I would never suggest that anybody should lose their job. I find it unseemly when people start talking that way. That said, you have to face the reality of the situation, which is that I think if he can right the ship, we're not talking about full steam ahead, but we're talking about everybody can put down the bucket. If he can get it to that point, I think he continues until the end of the year, because what is the other option? I know, you know, all kinds of names being thrown around, Steve Nichol prime among them, but at this point, what change can a coach fundamentally make mid-season with a team that is, when he comes in, will be in disarray? Because when he comes in, that means the coach has been fired. I think if he can get it back to a sort of 500 team, whether or not they make the playoffs, I think he's secure until the end of the year. Then I'm not sure. At this point, it all looks so muddy. Like you really can't see a way out of it. The one thing that will be coming is that Julian de Guzman's contract will be off the books, so there's room for another DP. That would be a big change, but I really don't think it's a problem of personnel. I see, as you pointed out, you're right, they've had some rotten luck, and I think there are a lot of bright spots. This is the brightest, on an individual basis, I think I've ever seen this team. So I think the pieces, or at least most of them, are probably there. The thing is, how do you fit them together in a way that works?
What kind of perception do you think the franchise would have if they have to go down that road and fire another coach?
At this point, see, this is, I think for Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment across all of their properties, their bad behavior is constantly rewarded because they do this again and again and again in all of their franchises. Toronto FC has just been the most emblematic in a lot of ways. It's the smallest of them, but it's the one that's just been the worst mismanagement. But people still come. People still come. We're talking about a relatively small fan base relative to the other three big teams in town, but that small fan base is enormously loyal. You know, I have a friend who works in branding. I was thinking about this the other day, and so he has to explain to clients when they put up something and they get social media response that the social media response can be terrible in a lot of cases. It's people complaining about how awful your product is. And he has to tell them it doesn't matter that people don't think your product is any good. What matters is that they're talking about your product. That's what Toronto FC is in the situation of. They see, what they don't see is apathy. They don't see disengagement. They don't see people say, forget this. What they see is people getting really, really angry. And really, really angry is just as good as really, really in love, as long as you continue to spend the money. And that's what people in this town do. So I don't know that fan base is going to change a great deal if there is upheaval. Where they will start, that management will start getting worried, is when something happens and nobody talks about it.
Do you think some of that social media stuff, though, might be sort of a really small group of hardcore fans being disproportionately sort of loud, making more noise?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it is. But they have so few metrics by which to judge this. Really, they have three. They have social media, they have the seats in the stadium, and they have the TV numbers. The TV numbers, as far as I understand, haven't really changed. Despite the talk that there are fewer people in the stadium, fewer is still relatively fewer. There, you know, you're still getting an 85, by my eyes, 80-85% full. And people are still howling about them on social media. So it's not as if any one of those three has fallen off a cliff.
So you say that what's most important there is that, you know, a product, in this case a sporting franchise, is being talked about. The upcoming friendly against Liverpool that was confirmed this week is getting a lot of talk, and it's getting, from what I've seen, overwhelmingly negative talk when it comes to the most ardent among the Toronto FC fans. The argument that's made on the other side is that, look, the game will sell out, whether it's Liverpool fans, Toronto fans, whoever's in the stadium. A full stadium watching Toronto FC helps re-engage the city and move the team back to the forefront of the sporting consciousness. What side of that do you come down on when it comes to what impact this friendly could have for the team?
Well, I think, you know, there's two sides to this. There's the sporting impact, and then there's the business impact. I think, as you point out, the business impact will be excellent. I mean, it's Liverpool. You know, despite the wretchedness of that team relative to where they are in the Premiership, they're still, you know, fourth, fifth, sixth biggest global fan base of any club. So it'll be full. And it, from a business perspective, most of the guys who sit on the board of Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment don't spend all of their weekends picking over Serie A results. All they see is, how did we do at that in that venue on that day? And it'll be full. So they think that's great. From a sporting perspective, it's inconceivable to me that Major League Soccer continues to allow this mid-season. It makes absolutely no sense. They always talk about how they want to be the biggest league in the world. Don Garber once said that he thought they could be the biggest league in the world in 10 years, and he said it with a straight face. He said it in Toronto. The biggest league in the world does not interrupt its schedule to barnstorm. No other league does this. I think if they ever really want to be taken seriously, they have to stop this.
You mentioned several times the ownership of the club, Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment, and as is usually the case in Toronto when a team isn't doing well, which is to say most of the time, the blame from fans tends to go upward. MLSE makes a good boogeyman. Kind of a faceless conglomerate that is the source of all the ills of the team. So we're starting to see more and more Toronto FC fans saying, look, this is MLSE's fault that the team is not doing well this season, hasn't made the playoffs since they've come into the league. Do you put any stock into those complaints? You've answered that a little bit already, but what do you think when you hear people say it's all MLSE's fault?
That's nonsense. Like, I mean, again, I've tried to make this point again and again. This is a salary cap league, so everybody starts with the same parameters. And now the DP's changed things, but Toronto is, you know, three of the league's 9 millionaires play for Toronto. So they've gone above and beyond. You know, it's one thing to say they hired the wrong people or they've made mistakes. They have, clearly, they have. To say that they somehow, it seems to, that there is this kind of paranoid belief that there's a cabal working against the team succeeding, which is just staggering on its face. The team, I know these guys, I deal with them. They want to win. Tom Anselmi, when it is constantly put on Tom Anselmi, that Tom Anselmi is the boogeyman at the top of this, is somehow undermines the team. Nobody wants this team to win more than Tom Anselmi for a variety of reasons, the main one of which would be it is much more fun to be in charge of a winning team. That said, you can blame them that they've made mistakes. You can say that, you know, this and that. You can parse all their moves or their hirings. But this is not down to some, it's because of apathy. They do care. They care a lot. They feel shamed that the team is not doing well. And they're incredibly frustrated. That said, they don't want to make these kind of knee-jerk moves. Like, you fire a coach after 6 games. What are you saying to the next guy? You're saying to the next guy, you lose 6 games in a row, you're probably out. So you have to keep faith on some level with this guy. We loved this guy a year ago. It's not working out as well as we'd hoped. That said, I think you have to stick with him a little further. There will, of course, come a point where it goes so wrong, or you do believe that he's completely lost the dressing room, that you have to make a move. But I think they're really going to wait on that, and I think that's probably right for the future of the club.
Do you think there's also maybe kind of a factor he just hasn't quite got his mind around MLS yet, MLS soccer?
I think that's such a huge part of it. You know, we saw, you know, the John Carver, the brief John Carver. In some ways, covering John Carver was the most fun thing I've ever done in sports, because I got to watch a professional coach come very, very close to a nervous breakdown right in front of you. Like, I remember those last days, that famous last press conference with John Carver sitting up there waving around a sheaf of papers talking about people that were working against him. I really did think the guy was going to start flipping tables and punching people. And, you know, and all of that was not because John Carver wasn't a good coach. He's gone back to the Premiership and proved he's an excellent coach. But the problem was he just could not adapt himself to many of the Bush League aspects of this league, the main one being the refereeing. He just could not wrap his head around the fact that in this league there is absolutely no consistency in officiating. And a lot of his hard plugging game was based on that idea. So I think a lot of Europeans come over here and they expect that high level, which applies in officiating and in the way that people perceive the club across Europe. Here, for a variety of reasons in Toronto, many of which have nothing to do with soccer per se, you know, people sort of shift around, and it's very hard to put a team together. It's very hard to know where to get the players. It's very hard to know what sort of talents are going to fit here or how you afford them. So I think Toronto makes another move, and I know Preki was technically an American, but they might want to think closer to home because Europeans seem to have a lot of trouble here.
Now, you talk about the difficulty of finding the right personnel in a league like MLS, and you also spoke a little bit earlier on about some of the contentious decisions that have made in terms of personnel when it comes to Toronto FC. And it seems that this has become more and more magnified over the course of the last year and a half. But one of the most contentious members of this team continues to be Julian de Guzman. He's a player that you've put under the microscope in your columns in the past. And so perhaps you could tell us a bit about what you perceive Julian de Guzman's role to be with this team at this moment and just what you think of his tenure with Toronto FC has been specifically in the recent past.
Well, this very question was put to Julian de Guzman, I guess it was last week. Somebody asked specifically, what is your role with the club right now? And his answer was to laugh. Because
sorry. Do you mean he laughed, or he said my role is to laugh?
No, he said he chuckled. He chuckled it with that. That was his answer, and then he sort of gathered himself and gave some mumbo jumbo about, you know, it's hard and I'm trying to find my place. But he doesn't know. If he can't know, then it's impossible for me to know because I don't think he has one. I've been hard on him. I'm hard on him in the main because he is not playing to his value. That's not his fault. You know, he's not a $1.9 million player, but he wasn't the guy who decided to overpay himself. That said, I'm not sure he has not shown in any way. He's a holding midfielder at best. He is not an outlet guy. He's not a strong passer. He does not have an enormously great sense of the game, or at least the MLS game right now, to my eye. He seems a little lost out there, and I think a lot of that may be down to the manager being unable to find a role for him. I mean, the guy clearly has some talents. I don't know about you guys. I didn't watch him a whole lot in Spain, so I'm not clear on why he was so great there. I based everything on what I've seen here, and what I've seen here is, you know, a guy really struggling to try and figure out what he can do to help the team. He is, I will say, he's a leader in the locker room. He is an articulate kid. He shows well for the club. But, you know, at $1.9 million, the chances that he's coming back are zero. And the chances that he can establish himself under those circumstances, the fact that he's not coming back, I think are probably also zero.
The main pillar of my argument, I told you before we started recording, that I was going to launch a defense of Julian de Guzman. But, I mean, you went and made my main argument for me, which was that he's not the one that decided to, you know, what his contract was going to be, and that I think he's unfairly judged through the prism of his contract, and that kind of overshadows every other facet of his play. But you know, as you said, we'll see where he goes from here.
Well, like, if you could field him, if you were his manager, what would you do with him?
Oh, now you've put me on the spot. Yeah, that's not how this is supposed to work.
I like how this is working.
I like this too.
No, this is a media conspiracy. You're working for MLSE against me. Why are you doing this, Cahal?
Well, you love the guy, so you know that's a question that whatever inventor makes, I'm just picking a number out of the air, $500,000 coach can't figure out. How would you use him?
Well, I'm worth nowhere near $500,000, so my insight is going to be even less useful than his. But I'm going to readily admit that a lot of my sentiment towards Julian is because I am first and foremost a Canadian fan, and I think that a lot of it comes out of just, and I think a lot of fans fall in the same boat, is just an earnest desire to see him do well, not just for the club, but for the country. Because there was a moment, or there was a time 4 or 5 years ago when he was indisputably the most dangerous and most talented player that the Canadian national team had at its disposal. And whatever the reasons behind it may be, obviously he has regressed during his time at Toronto FC. I don't think that he's regressed to the point where he is deserving of some of the criticism that he's faced. And I think, as you've said and as I've said, a lot of that criticism is predicated on his contract, in which he, you know, that's not his fault. It's Mo Johnson's fault. But I think that I want him to go out there and I want him to do well because I have high hopes for him. But, you know, the more that time goes on, it's you know, nobody's getting any younger, as they say. You've said, Cajal, that this season is done in terms of the MLS campaign. So we're only six games in. So at this point, what do the fans and what do the players have to look forward to in the season? Is it a matter of the Canadian Championship and the CONCACAF Champions League and just focusing on that? Or is it just about the fun of watching the game?
Well, I guess it's got to be, you know, that's the true definition of being a supporter, right? Is you watch the team to watch the team. You don't necessarily watch it to watch it win. If it was watch it to watch it win, nobody would show up at Wolves games, but they still do. So, I mean, that is how soccer is a little different in a lovely way from other sports, is that you can support and love and enjoy a team that isn't terribly good. I think the year is done for them in terms of the playoffs. It would certainly be nice to see if they could put together a string of games and a run of games. I think that is possible. I just think the way the league works, you just don't see teams make up those sorts of deficits, especially a team in turmoil like this. I'd love to see them change the formation. You know, it seems idiotic when reporters talk about formations, because really it's kind of nonsense. But at this point, I would love to see them try to defend before they try to attack, because the attack, all attack route is not working out. I would love to see them develop like talents. They have some enormous talents, like Luis Silva. You know, this side of Maurice Adoo is probably the most exciting rookie they've ever had there. Ryan Johnson looks fabulous. Reggie Lamb suddenly looks very good. Torsten Frings, the other thing too, is try to get Torsten Frings on side. He really saw that he is absolutely the linchpin of everything they want to do, and he's clearly, based on last week, getting upset at the way things are working. I rarely seen him outside of his first game screaming as much on the pitch as he was in the last game, and he was apoplectic by the end of it. And I think you have to put that guy into the role he wants to be. He talks a very good team first game, and I think he believes it. I'm actually sure he believes it. But I also think he thinks, I'm not doing much good here. And there was that moment when the through ball, the third goal, and he's sprinting back and he has absolutely no chance, and they go right around the goalkeeper, and it's, you could just see, you know, why am I here? Because I'm not doing my best work here. He needs to be up in midfield. And I would hope Julian de Guzman behind him, playing that sort of sweeper role that I think he might be better at. At this point, I think Julian de Guzman's problem, beyond having lost a step naturally, is confidence. And his coach clearly has no confidence in him, and he's reflecting that in his play.
Oh, Cajal, I just wanted to quickly here before we go switch gears entirely, talk about European football for a second.
Sure.
I have to confess, I'm a Chelsea supporter, yeah. So I'm trying to sort of digest what I've seen over the past 2 days. But you'd written a column a couple weeks ago talking about a Barcelona Real Madrid final.
Here we go.
Yes.
And I think most people in the world would have agreed with you that was going to happen. But I just want your prediction now that we've got Bayern and Chelsea. I'm going to give you the chance to go at this again. And what do you see happening?
Well, I know. Actually, in that column, as I was reminded by several emailers, I referred to Chelsea and Bayern as speed bumps.
I was actually going to bring that up, but yeah, I thought I would give you a pass.
Yeah, and most people were very nice about it, and a few were extremely cruel about it. But, I was completely wrong on that. What can I say? How could I have known? I mean, Lionel Messi misses a penalty. Are you kidding me? Anyway.
And Fernando Torres scores.
Yes.
Speaking of regaining confidence.
Yes. Though it was a lovely goal, reminiscent of the goal that won Euro 2008. So
yep.
maybe that sparked something. It's easy for me to make this prediction, because wouldn't you always go with the home team? Like, Bayern in a completely unusual position, getting
wouldn't,
to play.
Wouldn't you always go with Barcelona?
At home, yeah. I still think I think Bayern has more weapons. Chelsea has, based on the what they're going to put out there, they have Drogba and, you know, Mata, who's not been, it looks a bit tired near the end of the year. And also, I think the huge loss there for Chelsea, like, Bayern is missing a few players, and they're really going to miss Bad Stoiber, I think. But the guy I think is really going to hurt Chelsea's Ramirez, who has, for me, been their player of the year. I think just absolutely. And the second player of the year might be Ivanovic, who's also going to be missing. So without Ramirez there, and that is the guy that really could have shut down Arjen Robben, I think it's Bayern.
There you have it. Straight from his brain to his mouth to our podcast. That has been Toronto Star columnist Cajal Kelly. Cajal, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Promotion relegation. Here it is. Here we go. Grant, who or what would you like to promote?
I'm going to promote Cristiano Ronaldo for for his goal celebration for the winning goal against Barcelona last Saturday, the so-called calm down celebration. Whereas, as opposed to going to the Bernabeu, to the Camp Nou, to the stands, and giving them the shush sign, he gave them kind of the calm down. Yeah. Everybody just calm down. I actually like that far better than the shush.
It's less insulting?
I think it is less insulting.
I think it's the exact same amount of insulting.
Well, he was kind of... Because it's just because Premier League players used to do that sort of shush thing to their own fans.
Yeah, I don't get that.
I don't really know where that came from, but it went from shushing your own fans to shushing the opposing fans.
Shushing the opposing fans makes sense. Shushing your own fans is kind of just like, oh, we're probably still going to lose, so don't get too excited.
I think it was just, I don't know, maybe it was like calm them down before they did some kind of more elaborate goal celebration. I don't know.
Okay. you need to hear this.
I'm not in the mind of Premier League players, but...
No. Well, Ronaldo's going to have a bit of time now to think about
to
ponder his next goal celebration. You know, probably not on a penalty kick. Jamie?
Yeah?
Who or what would you like to promote?
I'm going to stick with Spain, the Spanish theme we've got here, and I'm going to promote Valencia. They're giving away free tickets to their Europa League semifinal second leg against Atletico Madrid to season ticket holders. And that the game is later today, which I think is fantastic. Everyone knows that this is kind of the also-ran European competition, and they just want to make sure that they have a great atmosphere and they get all the support that they need. And instead of just trying to forgetting about that, they're going to give away tickets, and it seems to reward supporters for coming out in the first place.
Wait a minute, Jamie.
You give me a wait a minute moment.
But you meant they're down in the first.
Yeah,
leg,
yeah. It's 4-2. I mean, they need all the support they can get, and I like the idea that they're recognizing how important the supporters are.
So what you're saying, Jamie, is that this club, this well-known, prestigious club in one of the biggest leagues in the world, is taking the measure of giving away tickets, or basically giving them away, because they realize that home support is the most important thing in an important game where you need a win. That's what you're saying.
I am.
What does Spain know about soccer?
No, I know.
Clearly, they've got no clue what they're doing.
They should be jacking the prices up.
They should be trying to bring Liverpool to town. That would really... Then they wouldn't have to give tickets away.
Well, they are playing in the Europa League, so...
Oh, yeah, that's true.
It is likely.
What are you going to promote?
I am going to promote a couple of referees for having real cojones. I suppose most male referees have cojones.
I believe it's pronounced Co-Jones.
Yes, right. Co-Jones. Golfer Don Co-Jones. First is Hungarian referee Viktor Kassai, who you probably recognize from the Real Madrid-Bayern Munich Champions League semifinal that took place yesterday. We're recording on Thursday. In the 111th minute, Esteban Granero came on the field. In the 115th minute, he took a ridiculous dive. And the referee, Mr. Kassai, rather than doing what most referees would do, which is just wave, play on, I'm not going to buy it, he went up and he yellow carded him. And you know, the debate about diving, we've had this on a previous show. We're not going to get into that. But if you want there actually to be a deterrent against players diving, you have to empower the referees to go out there and actually punish them when they see it. Not just say, oh, play on, I can't tell the difference. Give them a yellow card. MLS actually gives retroactive fines for diving. So I think that's...
I believe the A-League is doing something like that, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Speaking of the A-League, the other co-promotion I have is for another referee, Jared Gillette, a 25-year-old who was given the assignment to ref the A-League Grand Final between the Brisbane Roar and Perth Glory. Anyone who enjoys watching the Perth Glory will not like me to say this, but if you guys saw it, it was the 95th minute, injury time, 1-1. Brisbane was coming back. One of their strikers went down in the area. Very controversial moment. Mr. Gillette pointed to the spot, winning penalty. Brisbane Roar retained their title as A-League champions. I think they won last year. Izzy Nakajima Ferran's on that team, so good for them. Anyway, very controversial call, and people say, oh, the referee shouldn't decide the game. Of course the referee decides the game. Every call that they make at any point in the game decides the outcome. Whether a penalty is called in the first minute or the 95th minute, it's the same thing. So this idea.
Did you see the actual call?
Yeah.
I did. And, well, yeah. It's yeah. still... It's still debatable, but the point is, I'm promoting him for having the cojones to make that call. Even if it was wrong. The point is, referees are always going to have an impact on the game, and we just kind of have to hope that it's the correct impact.
Yeah, okay.
Grant?
Yep.
Who or what would you like to relegate other than me? Because you were kind of...
I'm relegating Squiz.
Aw.
I'm going to relegate. I'm going to join the wide and varied chorus of voices who are relegating FIFA for this... Or UEFA for this whole thing about players missing the Champions League final.
Oh, gee. Now, why ever would you say that, Grant, as a Chelsea fan?
Wait a minute.
No. But let me finish. Bayern Munich is also going to be missing three of their players.
Mm-hmm.
Two of their defenders. One of their central midfielders. And so the International Players Union has actually asked today for UEFA to just change this. To make it like they made the 2010 World Cup. Where the yellow cards you get in the semifinals don't actually carry forward.
Like everything wipes out after the semifinals.
Or after the quarterfinals.
Except for John Terry's red card.
Yeah, John Terry would still
They're not asking for that to be changed. They're just asking for it to be like the 2010 World Cup where the yellow cards were waived after the quarterfinals, which to me makes a lot of sense. And of course, I'm going to be accused of bias because I just support Chelsea.
You should be happy that John Terry's out of the final. He won't miss the decisive penalty kick this time.
I already made that joke on Twitter.
He should have also...
Well, if it already happened on Twitter,
exactly.
Then...
You're late to it.
But now is his big chance to knee the ball into the net.
Which would be very tough from the spot, but...
He's got some back.
Okay, so Grant is relegating UEFA. Jamie?
Yeah.
Who or what would you like to relegate?
I'm going to relegate another professional football body, the Professional Footballers Association in England, who... This is just a ridiculous human decision. This is not really a soccer decision. They had their over the weekend. They had their kind of end of year player awards. The PFA voted on by the Players Association. So on the Friday, Ched Evans, a striker for Sheffield United, was convicted of rape and sentenced to 5 years in prison. And then on the Sunday at the player awards, he was named to the team of the year. And it wasn't just we were unaware of it and we didn't have time to change it. It was a conscious decision to leave him on this team, to have people stand there and applaud at a formal ceremony for this man who's been convicted of rape. And they said it would have drawn more attention to it if we had have pulled him. But I think drawing attention to people being...
Drawing attention to the fact that you... don't condone that crime is probably good attention.
Drawing attention to the negative consequences of committing a horrible crime is a good thing. And obviously, there's a lot of attention on the fact that they didn't, and nobody's coming out looking good. He's still convicted of rape, and now they look like idiots. So I'm relegating
bad
them.
Bad move on all parts.
Yeah, nobody comes out of this good.
No.
Except for me, because I'm drawing attention to everybody being bad.
And you get a relegation out of it.
I did.
For my relegation, I'm going to turn this into a delegation. I think I had an overextended pro rel segment last week. Jamie, I promised you, and I heard you kind of say, I hope so. Listen to the tape. I'm going to turn my relegation over to you, Grant.
Really?
So, yes. Who, on behalf of me, would you like to also relegate?
Did you discuss this before, Tom, or are you just putting Grant on the spot?
No, we discussed it, sort of. I'm going to relegate Young Boys.
The club.
Swiss Soccer Club.
I thought you said, earlier you said you weren't going to undermine children. Now you're relegating Young Boys. What the hell?
The Swiss Soccer Club Young Boys has basically, as far as I know, and again, I don't have all the details, but
you don't have any of the details.
They are going to not exist, or they're going to be suspended from the Swiss, Super League next season?
Yeah. Ultra League.
No, Ultra League.
Mega League.
It's the Super League.
Hyperion League.
Ooh, I like the sound of that, though.
The Centurion League. So they're not going to be in that next year because of some sort of financial irregularity.
In Switzerland?
Yeah, no,
what?
I know. I can't understand it. But Canadian midfielder and international Josh Simpson plays for Young Boys. So I don't know what he's going to do because he had a bit of a bad run of it because he kind of left Turkey for similar reasons last year, I believe.
Yeah.
So I really hope he can sort himself out. So I guess, I don't know I guess I'm relegating the owners of Young Boys. I'm going to relegate their accountants.
Any particular owner that deserves special attention, you think, Jamie?
This is by no means limited to Young Boys. This is kind of across the Swiss Super League. There's a bunch of teams.
Hyperion League.
The Hyperion League, yeah. The FC Zurich, Young Boys, I think Sion, Servette Geneva, and Neuchâtel Xamax are all being kicked out of the top league.
No Grasshoppers?
No, I think Grasshoppers bring in money on their own. I mean, people love Grasshoppers. And then Neuchâtel Xamax, apparently owned by were owned by a Chechen gentleman named Bulat Chagayev, who he has, well, let me just see here, because, oh, yes, him, he's been arrested for financial mismanagement of the team, and the headline that I'm reading says, stricken Swiss side Neuchâtel Xamax slipped from crisis into shame and near oblivion on Thursday, which seems like a horrible kind of slide.
But didn't he also, he had some weird antics associated with him, too.
There's a rumor that I've heard around the rumor mill that he kind of went into the dressing room after a bad performance of the team with a gun and just kind of threatened all the players. So he seems like, if these rumors are true, he is a lunatic.
I wonder if that made them play better.
Probably not.
We continue to spread uncorroborated stories. Professionalism at its finest. Mm. That's the end of promotion relegation.
It's corroborated on the internet.
Yeah, why not? But that brings us to Taste the Trivia, which we had an edition of last week, but we are going back into the regular cycle this week. Question provided by a listener. Answer will be provided by another listener who will be the beneficiary, the recipient. They'll get some Umbro swag. So the question given to us a couple weeks ago by Scott Bennett is as follows. What university did Nova Scotia native and former Canadian women's national team regular Suzanne Muir attend, and at what two varsity sports did she excel? Looking for three pieces of information there. If you have the correct answer and are the first one to provide it on our Facebook page at facebook.com/somecanadianguys, you will be this week's winner of Taste the Trivia. We will call upon you to provide an answer for next week's for next week's show, and we will send you some Umbro swag. And congratulations as well to Clemente Miranda, who was the winner of last week's Taste the Trivia and has received or will soon receive couple of tickets to Canada v. Honduras coming up in June.
He's flying his family out to Toronto.
Yeah. That brings us up to the end of the show. But if you want to interact with us in the intervening time until next week, you can, of course, head to our Facebook page. You can check in on what Jamie's writing at sportsnet.ca, or you can follow him on Twitter at...
Doyle_Jamie.
There you go.
I can't remember how I have that ordered.
Grant, you can also keep up on him at CanadianSoccerNews.com or on Twitter at...
It's SCG Grant.
I'm also at Canadian Soccer News and on Twitter at Daniel Squizzato, DanielSquizzato. Jamie. We will hopefully be yammering at you again next week. Till then, we are, as always, some Canadian guys talking about soccer.